Okay. All right. So welcome back to Why Do We Do That, where we discuss why we do things in Judaism, to put it succinctly. So as I mentioned, I wanted to start with a couple of sessions, at least, probably at least two parts, on customs of tefillah, of davening, and things that we do which relate to davening. So today I want to talk about two things: washing hands in the morning, otherwise known as Nagelwasser. I'm not exactly sure what Nagel means, because I don't speak Yiddish, but it's called Nagelwasser in Yiddish. Wasser means water. And the second...
Nail water.
Is it? Nagels or nails?
Yeah.
It will make sense.
Ongle is French.
There's a very funny... I'll just let you in on this joke. In YU, in New York, there's a room called Nagel Commons, N-A-G-E-L. That's the last name of the person who dedicated it. So on Purim, someone put a sign on the water fountain in Nagel Commons that said Nagelwasser. That's a funny joke. Anyway, whatever. I don't know why that just came to mind. But anyway, we're talking about Nagelwasser, and also we're going to talk about Birkot HaShachar, which, as we'll see, breaks basically into two chunks, because there are two major sources for the concept of saying the brachas that we say in the morning, Birkot HaShachar. Okay, so let's start with washing your hands in the morning. There's some sort of idea that when we wake up in the morning, we're supposed to wash our hands. How and exactly when, I don't want to talk about all the details. We'll get into some of the details, but I want to look at the sources for this first, a couple of sources from the Gemara, and then there's a very particular debate amongst Rishonim about what exactly is the nature, what is the basis, why are we doing this? And that informs a lot of the halakhic discussion afterwards. So if we look at the first source, apologize for not numbering the sources, first source is the Gemara in Brachot, and the Gemara in Brachot is describing, we'll see some of the other parts of it later, but just the process of when a person wakes up, when you actually become conscious in bed, there's a certain bracha you say, and when you open your eyes, there's a bracha you say, when you hear the rooster crow, there's a bracha you say, and there's a whole process of different things that you say as you get out of bed, and you get dressed, and you put on tefillin, and part of this process is washing your hands. The Gemara says, ki mashe yedei, when he washes his hands, when a person washes their hands, lema, let him say, baruch asher kichanu mitzvotav tzivanu al netilat yadayim. Make the bracha that we make every morning. We make it now when we get to shul. Most people make it when they get to shul. It's a little bit debatable about whether it should be made when you get to shul or not. But nevertheless, we see that the Gemara is saying that you need to make a bracha when you wash. Apparently, you have to wash your hands as part of waking up and make a bracha on washing your hands.
I heard, by the way, you're supposed to do your eyes as well. You're supposed to, somehow wet your eyes.
Part of this Gemara, the description is when you move the stuff from your eyes, you say, "Hamavir shena meinai tuma mafapai." Exactly. So this is part of that process. Okay, so this is one source. The second source, there's a few places where it's described, but this sort of frames it differently. Kol hanifne v'notel yadav u'miniach tefillin v'korek kriyat shema u'mitpalel ma'ale alav akatuv ki'ilu bana mizbeach v'hikriv alav korban. Anyone who relieves himself in the morning and washes his hands and puts on tefillin and reads shema and then prays, says Shmona Esrei, it's considered as though he built an altar and he brought a korban, an offering, on the altar. As it says, erchatz benikayon kapai, I will clean out my hands, my palms, with purity or with cleanliness, and I will surround your mizbeach, your altar, O God. So the idea is that there's some sort of notion of cleaning oneself, which relates to going to the bathroom and also washing your hands. There's other descriptions in other places when we say that kol kravai, all of my insides should praise God. So there's a notion of relieving oneself before praying, for among other reasons that one should relieve oneself before praying, and also to right, and then you put on your tefillin and pray, so it's as though you have built an altar and sacrificed something on it. And washing your hands is part of that process. So this is the idea. We see these sources here. One of them sort of clearly points to some sort of idea of service of God. This is involved in the general practice of service of God. That's the second source. The first source is not so clear, because you're just doing everything that you do when you wake up in the morning. You get out of bed, and you get dressed, and you wash your face, and you wash your hands. Just things people would do anyway. It almost sounds like it's an issue of hygiene, as opposed to something else, but it's associated with a bracha. You're supposed to make a bracha on it. So these are two sources that we see of this concept. So now we'll go through a few different opinions about what exactly the basis is. Where does this come from? The first thing we see here is the Rosh. Rosh, one of the medieval commentators, is commenting on this Gemara. We've encountered him before. So he says, Ki mashe yedei, when a person washes their hands, they say, Omer Baruch Asher Kitshanu B'mitzvotav Etzivanu. That's that Aleph Kuf Bet Vav. Al Netilat Yadayim. Blessed, etc. I just put in etc. But we say the bracha regarding washing hands. Lefisha Yadav Shel Adam Askani Otem. Because a person's hands are busy, it means they touch all different places and parts. They move around when one is sleeping. It's impossible that they don't touch some, what he calls, dirty part of the body at night. Part of Chazal's understanding of hygiene in general, and we see their halachas which reflect this, is that there are certain things which you touch, which you do, which make your hands dirty, and you should wash your hands afterwards. There's a whole list of them. If you touch your hair and you're cleaning lice out of your hair, when people had lice a lot and they had to do that. If you touch your shoes or you touch
money,
okay, could be is also part of it. Or if you touch some part of your body which is normally covered by clothing, or if you go for bloodletting, hopefully nobody goes for bloodletting. I mean, apparently it's sometimes used medically, but if you go for bloodletting, if you donate blood, so that's a good common modern example. Contemporary example, so you have to wash your hands. All these things are considered hygienic practices. So if you touch some unclean part, some normally hidden or covered part of your body, then you have to wash your hands. And so the Rosh is saying, presumably, this occurred at night. So this notion of washing your hands when you wake up in the morning is based on this hygienic practice of washing your hands if you touch somewhere which is not clean. That's the opinion of the Rosh. The Rashba has a little bit more religiously charged kind of idea. He says, "Shebeshachar anu nasim kabriya chadasha." Every morning we are made like a new creature. It's like we're created fresh, new. It's a new day. We're a new person, and it's a new world. As it says, "Chadashim labkarim rabba bunatecha." New with each day, with each morning. Actually, your great is your faithfulness. Idea is that God creates the world anew. It's somehow a new world every day. Ukmo shebalahem zal b'midrash, as Chazal have explained in the Medrash. V'tzrichin anu lehodot lo itbarach al shebra anu lichvodo ulesharto ulevarich b'shmo. We need to thank God in so far as He's created us to honor Him, to serve Him, and to bless His name. Val davar ze tiknu b'shachar kol otan brachot shanu mevarchin b'kol boker uboker. And because of this, Chazal established, we'll come back to this when we talk about the Birkot HaShachar, but Chazal established all of the brachas that we say in the morning, this whole list of brachas, and one of them is that you have to wash your hands. Why? Lefikach anu tzrichim lehitkadesh b'kedushato. We have to sanctify ourselves in His sanctity and wash our hands from a vessel, from a container, a kli, kakohen shemekadesh yadav min hakiyor kodem avodato. Like a Kohen would do, and wash his hands from the Kior, which I didn't have a good translation for, before his Avoda. What is this referring to? In the Beit HaMikdash, there was this giant, in pictures of it, it has like bulls. It's like a picture of like a big water jug with bulls' heads coming out of it. They had this thing called the Kior, and where Kohen would wash their hands. It would have water in it, and you could have it had a spout, and you could take water into a kli or whatever and wash your hands. So the part of the process for the avoda, for the service in the temple, was even if it's not an issue of purity and it's not an issue of cleanliness, when the Kohen comes, part of his preparation for the service is to wash his hands out of this kiur, even if there's no other reason to do so. It's just preparation. So the Rashba says we are created anew every day, and we're facing kind of a new world, and we're engaging ourselves in the service of God. That's what we're created for. So as part, just like a Kohen prepares himself to do his avoda, to do his service by washing his hands, we also prepare ourselves for the day by washing our hands. And this turns into a question about whether this is for the whole day, or maybe it should apply every time we pray. You should do it before Shacharit and Mincha and Maariv, or Mincha Maariv maybe once if you're going to be in shul for one continuity. So that's a separate question, but this is the idea of the Rashba. So far we have hygiene, which is one possibility. This notion of preparing yourself for the day, which the Rashba is saying. And there's a third possibility also, which is much more Kabbalistic. So Kabbalistic that I brought the Zohar here. So that doesn't get more Kabbalistic than that. So the Zohar says that something very dramatic and incredible happens to a person while they are sleeping. Leit lecha bar nash be'alma de'la ta'im ta'ama demota be'lelia. There is no such person who does not taste the taste of death in the nighttime. V'ruach mesava sharya al hahu gufa. So what happens is, the dynamic is, the assumption, I'm not an expert in Kabbalah by any means, but the person's soul has many components, and only some of the components are down in this, you know, in the person's body. The other components are in higher spiritual planes. When you go to sleep, your soul sort of like shifts upwards, and it leaves a kind of vacuum in your body.
I think it says in the Zohar that sleep is 1/70th of death.
The Gemara says that sleep is 1/60th of death. So 1/60th of death happens when you sleep. At a simple level, it just means I'm not conscious and I'm not thinking and I'm not aware of my surroundings. And it's sort of like being dead. Somebody sees you and they don't know any better.
So the Ruach, I mean, I know there's four different souls in the body. There's Ruach, Nefesh, the Ruach is a higher one, you're saying?
So there's Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, I think it's five parts. It depends how you divide it. Right. Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, and then there's Yechida. Ruach, and Neshama are the three that are in the body. Okay. That's the assumption. So I don't know exactly what that means. Yeah. I just know the terms. So in any event, the assumption is there's some sort of movement where your soul is going up into higher realms, and that leaves a sort of spiritual vacuum in your body, and forces of impurity then rest on your body. Okay, my tama. So yes, this is why is it that forces of impurity happen? Begin the nishmita kedisha istalka mine de barnash v'nafkat mine, at the time when the holy soul, a person's soul, sort of goes up from it and leaves. So at that time, minei sharya rucha misava al haugufa. So at that time, a spirit of impurity rests upon the body. Ve'istev, and the whole body becomes impure. Ve'kad nishmata it hadarat legufa, when the soul comes back down into the body, it avar hauzuama. So the impurity and the shmutz that were associated with it are sort of expelled from the body. V'ha itmar. But we say that in the hands, in the fingertips, or on your hands, some of this, there is some residual kind of this impurity, which remains there. And therefore, it has to be washed away. So this is what is called, in the non-Zohar language, Ruach Ra. It's an evil wind. It's a wind of impurity, of evil, literally. But the idea is that there's some sort of impure iti which is resting on your hands.
So would this be, I guess, the spiritual reason why you wash a body before you bury it?
There is a process of purification. The body is tame anyhow.
Oh, I
could be
that's
true.
I don't know. I'm asking.
It could be that's true. I'm not sure. I don't want to say that it's true because I'm not sure.
No.
It's an interesting point.
But it is. Maybe we'll add it to our list of things. Okay, so yes. So there's a notion here that this is on your hands. This is not the only place we encounter Ruach Ra. Ruach Ra is also something we know appears in the bathroom. It's the reason why there's certain things you're not supposed to do in the bathroom, and also it gets complicated in terms of washing your hands in the bathroom. Okay. But there's a concept of Ruach Ra, which is on your hands. As a result of this Ruach Ra, several of the halachas, several of the things that we do, which we associate with washing our hands in the morning, sort of make an appearance. Rav Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, was a staunch Kabbalist, and so he took these three reasons that we've mentioned so far into account. Each of them contributes a little bit. The last one, contributes a lot, because there's a very specific way that you must get rid of the ruach ra, which is on your hands. Well, part of it is the continuation of this quote. How do you sanctify your hands? Heich bai li'it kadsha, bai chad kli letata v'chad kli mila'ela. So you need two vessels, two containers, one which is below, one which is above. In order to pour, so that you're pouring from one of them into the other one, which will catch the water. The assumption is that the water, which now contains this ruach ra, is very bad. You can't use it for anything. You shouldn't spill it on the floor. You should spill it out somewhere far away or into the toilet or whatever and get rid of it. So this is part of the idea here. So this is the third reason. Third reason is that you have ruach ra on your hands. So far we have hygiene, this notion of the world being created fresh and you are preparing yourself to serve God, and the spiritual tumah, impurity, which rests on your hands after you wake up at night, because your body has been inhabited by some sort of bad spiritual forces. So there are a couple of points, as I mentioned, that sort of branch out of this last notion of ruach ra. One of them is that you need to have these two, you need a kli to catch the water, because if you don't have it, then it's really bad. According to the other two reasons, there's no problem. You wash your hands onto the ground, onto wherever, it doesn't make any difference. Certainly according to the Rashba, who says it's just an issue of preparing yourself for the day, there's no impurity that's going on here at all.
So once you wash your hands, that water, if you put it into some sort of vessel as a catchment, you can't use it to wash somebody. What someone else can?
No, certainly not. The assumption is you can't use it for. You shouldn't use it for anything. You shouldn't even have it around. You got to get rid of it. Mm-hmm.
Can you use for irrigation?
Pour it onto. I wonder if they say that. I don't know if it's said there that you literally can't use it for anything. I think that the implication seems to be you should just get rid of it and not use it
for anything, because if you just pour it in the ground, it's serving a purpose.
It's serving a purpose, right. But you should get, it sounds like the idea is get this away from people as much as possible and get rid of it. I'm not 100% clear on what precisely you might be able to do with this water. Okay, so that's one rule. Another rule we see here in the Chai Adam, Chai Adam said there's two other rules that come out, which are you're not supposed to walk anywhere from your bed. You should stay inside of your bed or next to your bed, not walk 4 amot away from your bed before you wash your hands. That's one of the ideas here. And the other idea is that is the process by which you wash your hands, the three times, which we'll see described here in the Chai Adam. Everybody quotes the Zohar as the basis for these two rules. I'm not an expert in the Zohar, I couldn't find it, and other people also say, at least this rule of the 4 amot from your bed, we'll see a fascinating description about it afterwards, is not necessarily found in the Zohar. But the Chai Adam says, among others, Asur leilach shelo letzorech gadol below netilat yadayim. When you wake up in the morning, it's forbidden to walk away from your bed, unless it's for some great important need, without washing your hands first. So now we need two kelim, one big one, one small one, to pour the water, and you put it next to your bed. So you may have encountered this before. This is something people do, particularly Hasidim do it. Other people do it also. I once heard someone describe that they tried to do this on an airplane, which I don't recommend. But somebody told, I wasn't there, but someone told me that he saw this person like trying to put water in a thing under his seat, and it spilled, and it was a whole mess, as you can imagine. So I don't know if that's necessarily a good idea. but people do this very seriously. So this is this idea. You have to prepare it.
You know, it's also very interesting. You know, you go to old, I don't know if you've ever been, if you ever stayed at bed and breakfast or some old houses that have bed and breakfasts, and quite often you will see right beside the bed a washing basin,
right.
I mean, it's odd that, and sometimes you don't even see with a tap. It's just like a basin, and the tap may have been in the washroom or something, but there's a basin there.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was a custom, maybe.
I always thought that was like a throwback to times when they didn't have running water, and that's what you did to prepare. No? Is that?
I don't know.
I can confirm that.
That's
yeah.
We had basins. We had no running water.
So you had to have something so you could wash up in the morning. That's what I always assumed, but maybe not.
Okay. It's just something you remark when you go to a hotel.
It's true.
Why do you see it there?
So he says you're supposed to prepare. V'tekach b'komo, as soon as you get up, yitol yadav al zeh haseder. You have to wash your hands in the following sequence. Get ready for this. You take the cup with your right hand, and you put it into your left hand, and then you pour onto your right hand, and then afterwards you take the cleat from your right hand and put it into your left hand. I'm doing this backward. And you pour into your right hand, your left hand into your right hand, you pour onto your left hand, and back and forth like that until you've poured on each hand 3 times. And this is the way in which this ruach tuma is eliminated. Al yedei zeh baal korcho holech ruach hatuma mimenu. Hatmeya mimenu. By doing this process, it gets rid of the ruach hatuma. It's important to note this, because when we wash our hands for a meal, you do it twice on each hand. And that's very important halachic reality. The assumption when you're washing for a meal is that this is parallel to a kind of tumah, a kind of impurity which Chazal established for Kohanim originally, because they had to be totally pure when they ate truma and certain other foods. So this was established for Kohanim, and the idea is that your hand is impure and you want to get rid of the impurity on your hand. So you pour the water 1 time, and then the idea is that that loosens the impurity and it goes into the water that's on your hand. And you pour another shot of water and that washes away the impure water. So when you're washing your hands for a meal, it's important not to touch the cup in the middle, because then the water that's on your hands, which is now not pure, will go onto the cup. And so what you're going to do is you would do like this. Now you have impure water in your hand. Take it into the other hand. Now there's impure water on the cup. You pour it like this. And now when you're doing this, and you take it for the second time, you're going to mess your hand back up.
So why 3 in the morning?
So apparently, this is a Kabbalistic idea. Mm-hmm. It has something to do with the tension. The right hand represents chesed, and the left hand represents gvura, and has something to do with the interplay between these two things. Back and forth 3 times gets rid of the tumah. As we'll see, the Vilna Gaon thought it should be 4 times. But, yeah.
So it's left hand, right hand specific. It's not left handers versus
right
handers.
Right. So I don't think this is a case of lefty versus righty. Right. No, I've got you. But so it's important to differentiate between this and washing for a meal. If you do this when you're washing for a meal, it can run into difficulty. But apparently in the morning, this is the way that you get rid of this stuff. Okay. That in regards to walking 4 amot, there's just a very interesting story from the Vilna Gaon. There was a Polish nobleman. He was a Polish prince or something, and he converted to Judaism in the times of the Vilna Gaon, which was very bad because it was a capital offense. He was a Christian, and it was a Christian country, and it was not good. And he disappeared for a certain time. I don't remember the exact details of the story, but he disappeared for a certain time, and then for some reason he had to come back. And there was his countrymen said, either you renounce your Judaism or we're going to kill you, because it's you're not allowed to do it. It's a heresy or whatever. You can't do that. And they put him in jail, and he was thinking about it and whatever, and and so the Vilna Gaon came to him to speak to him, and he said, if you do this, you're going to be among one of the great kedoshim of all time. You'll be a tremendously holy person, so just so you know, like, it's going to be okay. So he in the end he did not renounce his Judaism, and he was burned at the stake, basically. And this is the person who's known as the Ger HaTzedek, or Ger HaTzedek HaKadosh. And if you hear the Vilna Gaon talking about the holy convert, this is this person. So as a result of this, well, just so you know the background there, the Gra thought this was such a momentous occasion spiritually that tremendous things occurred in the spiritual realms, and one of them had to do with our halachas. So I'll read this. We can read this now. This is at the bottom of the first page. HaGra His here shelo lelech dalad amot below netilat yadayim shacharit. So the Vilna Gaon also warned, as we've seen, that you shouldn't leave your bed, you shouldn't walk 4 amot in your house in the morning before you wash your hands. V'av shel nizkar b'zohar yesh lachmir. Even though we haven't found a source for this in the Zohar, one should still be stringent. B'sefer halichot Shlomo. That's Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach from Yerushalayim, one of the great poskim of the previous generation in Yerushalayim. He wrote that Shashama mizikne Yerushalayim. Shekabala b'yadam ish mi pi ish ad hagrach mi v'lajin. He heard from the older people in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was originally settled, or there was a large contingent of students of the Vilna Gaon who came to Israel, and they set up a settlement. They started to populate the land. So there's a lot of old students and traditions from the Vilna Gaon that are hanging around in Yerushalayim. So they had an oral tradition from Reb Chaim of v'lajin, who was the star, the main student, the primary student of the Vilna Gaon, Shoshama Mirabenu Hagrazal, that he heard from the Vilna Gaon the following. Shebashah Shenisraf Hager Tzedek HaKadosh Avram Ben Avraham Al Kedushat Hashem. At the moment when this holy convert was martyred, Beyom Betchel Shavuot Shnat Taf Kuftet, which is in the second day of Shavuot, I left it as a question mark there, it's 1748, that was the year. Bik'a shal hevet eish mi Ma'arat HaMachpelah, so a jet of fire shot out of Ma'arat HaMachpelah, v'hasitra achra ivda mikocha. The sitra achra in Kabbalistic terms is the other side. It's like the forces of evil were weakened. U'ba'ota sha'a nechlesha tumat yadayim shal shacharit. The result of this whole interplay was that there was a weakening of the forces of impurity that come onto your hands in the morning. This was what the Vilna Gaon said. And as a result, he doesn't spell this out, but as a result, apparently, according to this tradition, the Vilna Gaon then said, now that this amazing thing has happened, you don't have to worry about this issue about not walking for Amod in your house. It's fine, you can walk somewhere and wash your hands and it's okay. So they asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, let's put this in here because it's just very, I don't know exactly what to make of it. It's a very interesting story because this is a halacha. Granted, we have no source, but the Vilna Gaon sensed that somehow this was now nullified. They asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, can we rely on this story? Can we rely on this tradition? To the people who asked him, how much can we be lenient based on this? Rav Shlomo Zalman Zatzal, she'ein lazuz min hamavur b'poskim. We shouldn't stop doing what we see written in books of halacha. Elo delo chamer kol kach le'inyan halacha dalanamot belo natila she'einu mafurish b'gemara. But that it's the whole idea is not so serious. I don't know exactly what to do with the words not so serious, because it's not in the Gemara, it's not in the Zohar, it's not anywhere. It just seems to have cropped up that this is what people do. Anyway, I thought it was an interesting tidbit that the Vilna Gaon felt based on this spiritual reality that maybe this doesn't apply. So that is basically what we have in terms of washing hands in the morning. Just to recap, there are three major reasons. One of them is hygiene. One of them is this idea that I'm preparing myself for the day to serve God. One of them is this spiritual idea that there is impurity, forces of impurity which are resting on my hands. And those three things come to the fore, and they inform sort of all the halachas that we have that surround this. There are a bunch of cases. These are the basic underpinnings of the halacha. So there's a bunch of cases where we get confused about whether or not you actually have to wash your hands, because it's not clear if these reasons apply. Like if somebody stays up all night. So if they stay up all night, there's no concern about touching bad parts of their body, because that's something that happens when you're sleeping automatically with your hands. But if you're awake, you can be conscious of your hands. The other two reasons are unclear if they apply if you didn't sleep. This notion that it's a new world, maybe that happens every day automatically. And the concept of this impurity setting in on your hands also is not clear. So anyway, that's just part of the discussion. So that's sort of the background of this idea of washing your hands in the morning. Questions, comments, concerns? Okay, so we'll move on to part two, which is the morning blessings. In the morning, we say a series of brachas. We say them now in shul. It hasn't always been clear that that was the case. And as we'll see here, it sounds like the straightforward reading in the Gemara is that you're supposed to say these things as you encounter them in the day, when you wake up in the morning. So we have a description here on the second page. Ki mita'er, when a person becomes conscious, even if they haven't opened their eyes, they're not out of bed, but they're just awake. Omer Elokai neshama, etc. You say Elokai neshama shenatata bi tehorahi, etc. This is one of the brachas that we say. I should have brought a list of them, but this is one of the things that we say. Elokai neshama shenatata.
Just one question.
Yeah.
In most Siddurim, except for the Art Scroll, you find these brachot before you actually would put on your talit katan. So it's obvious that you probably not supposed to recite them before you get dressed, or as you get dressed. So isn't it like, I mean, it's not a bad thing that you don't recite them then, but why is there a change now that we do them in the shul?
So the there's a question, it's a little bit of a debate amongst the interpreters in the Gemara. Is, as we'll see here, this description will have them in sequence. Let's finish the description and I'll answer your question. Okay, so when a person becomes conscious, you say, L'kai neshama, ki shama kol tarnagola, when you hear the cry of the rooster. Once upon a time, people woke up because of the cry of the rooster, or at least that was the indication that the dawn is coming. Leima baruch asher natan l'sechvi vina. So then you say the first bracha, who gives the sechvi wisdom. The sechvi might mean rooster, or it might mean your heart, which is very big variance, because I think it's because it's a very, very uncommon word, sechvi. So it could mean who gives the rooster wisdom, or who gives my heart the heart wisdom to tell the difference between night and day. Fine, ki patach eine, when you open your eyes, you say baruch pokeach ivrim, blessed is the one who gives sight to the blind. Ki lavish, when you get dressed, you say baruch malbish armim, right, which makes sense, who clothes the naked. Ki zakif, when you straighten out, the assumption was you got dressed, I think, in bed. When you straighten out, you say baruch zokef kefufim, blessed is the one who straightens the bent. Ki nachit la'ara, when you step down into the ground, you say baruch rokeh aratz l'mayim, blessed is the one who, how did I translate this, firm dry land upon the water. I mean, there's dry land there for me to stand on as opposed to an ocean. And I just gave an example of a few of them. But as you see, the description seems to be, as you progress through the sequence of events in the morning, you say all of these brachas. So there are two debates here. One debate was, is this really necessary, or can I just say them all later, right? And the other debate was, do I only say them if I actually encounter all of these events, or do I say them anyway? And it's sort of parallel debate. If I didn't hear a rooster, I never hear a rooster. I've never heard a rooster. I mean, in the morning, crow, as far as I know. It's too bad. Have you heard? Okay, so sure. So, but maybe if I didn't hear the rooster, and you know, I can't say this about an alarm clock, so then maybe I should never say Yashir Natan L'Sechvi Vina. So what we hold at the end of the day is that the ideal is you have to say all of them, and ideally they should be said as you encounter these things in the morning. But because people don't know them all off by heart, and it's difficult to remember to do this, so this is a whole very sophisticated dance. I'm conscious, then I open my eyes, then I get dressed. It's very hard to sort of remember all of this. So we do something which is not ideal and say them all in shul together as one unit. That's basically how with the practice. But there are those who held that anyhow you can say them all in shul. It's not, and we'll see as we'll look through a few of the reasons here why exactly that might be. So this is what you say. This accounts for most of the morning blessings. It's divided into two parts. There are three which are not included in this Gemara, in this source, which are Shelo Asani Goy, Shelo Asani Eved, Shelo Asani Isha. That will be part two, which has the most controversial part. Okay, so this is what we say. We have the sequence of brachas that we say. Why do we do this? Why are we doing this? The Rambam has a description of why we're saying these particular things as opposed to others. He doesn't explain why we are saying these all together, but the Rambam says, "Kishetiknu chachamim divrei tefilot elu." He's describing the Shmona Esrei. We have the Shmona Esrei, it's 18 brachas, right? That requirement to say these 18 things is not the requirement from the Torah. You have to pray every day according to the Torah. You actually have to say, according to the Rambam, a sequence of praises of God and requests. Sorry, praise of God and requests and thanksgiving in that order. Shevach, Bakasha, Hoda, which we say, but there's no actual text that you have to say. The rabbis, Chazal, created a text, and he said it's because at a certain point, people lost the ability to express themselves properly, so they created a text so that everybody can pray in the most poetic and a very proper way. And here he says, there's all kinds of brachas that we say all the time. We don't really make up our own brachas, especially if we're saying with the name of God. So they also created certain brachas. Kishetiknu chachamim divrei tefilot elu. When the rabbis established, created these prayers, tiknu brachot acherot levarechotan b'kol yom eluhen. And they also created other blessings that we say every day. So this is part of that series of blessings. That doesn't explain why we're saying them necessarily. The Torah has an explanation. There's a description in the Gemara. I mean, it comes from a description in Tanakh that in the days of King David, there was a plague that was happening, which was killing 100 people a day. And David prayed, and then eventually they figured it out, and he had to do tshuva for something, and then it was fixed. But the Gemara understands that part of what they discovered was there's 100 people dying a day, so they created this notion that everyone should say 100 blessings every day. You heard about this idea? Yeah, 100 brachas.
But I didn't know that story.
This is the background for the story. In the days of King David, it was parallel to the 100 people that died every day. Everyone should say 100 brachas a day. You have to say 100 blessings a day. So obviously that requires a lot of new blessings. If you don't have a lot of blessings to say, especially since we only say whatever Chazal created. So as a response to that, later, Chazal created a lot of different kinds of blessings that you can say in different circumstances, and these ones in the morning, which are reacting to the world and to the sort of natural order and so on, are a series that they create in the morning so that we can fill out this number of 100. Yeah.
I'm going to throw something out. It's a bit intriguing, so I'll ask your judgment here. You know, when you think about Adam Arishon and Chava in Gan Eden, you actually almost see a parallel between their experience and these brachot in the order that they're saying here in the Gemara. You know, so, you know, God created the world. Their eyes were closed because they didn't see, right? They had to eat the fruit. And then their eyes opened. They saw that they were naked. They had to put clothes on. And then, you know, then they committed a sin. They were cast out of the garden. I mean, so it's almost like, well,
that's interesting.
I don't know if there's a parallel and why the three that are taken out have nothing to do with Gan Eden, but these all can sort of be paralleled with experiences.
That's very interesting.
Eden.
Those are basic needs for. It's interesting.
I'm just throwing it out because it's almost intriguing that there's a, you know, you see the creation of man.
Maybe it'll continue to work. Yes. Good timing, Pen. Okay, got to think about that. Very interesting. Okay, so it could be. So in any event, the tour is going to argue that these brachas were, this is what he's going to say. V'tikein lehem le'Yisrael, kuf brachot. So there are 100 brachas that we have to say. V'al ken tiknu chachamim zal elu habrachot seder ha'olam v'hanhagato v'hashlim kuf brachot b'kol yom. That's why the rabbis created these brachas that we say every morning, which react to the natural order in order to fill out, to complete the 100 blessings that we have to say every day. V'tzarech kol adam lizahir behan v'apochet al yifchot v'mosif yosif al kol bracho bracha shenitkena. A person has to be careful to use this exact text. You shouldn't detract from it. You shouldn't add to it. This is the text that you're supposed to be using of these brachas. So that's one option, which is that we're talking about we need to fill out this 100 brachas. It's not for any particular reason other than we need to fill out the number.
Isn't that on a fast day? That's why you have to add some. I think there's something to do
on Yom Kippur, there's always a challenge because you can get a bunch of them out of eating, right? If you bench, you say Birkat HaMazon has 4 brachas in it, and eating before you have a bracha, so you get 5 right there just out of eating.
10 at least a day, yeah.
Right? So you eat 2 meals a day, you have 10, that's good. You're going to lose them all. So that's why a lot of times on Yom Kippur, people have like besamim. They have like some sort of smelly stuff, and you smell it throughout the day. So that's also nice. It sort of wakes you up a little bit, but it also helps you to make up this number of brachas. Yeah. There's different ways you have to do it.
And there's also, I remember the reading about the issue of Ashrei, that why you recite it 3 times a day is because I think 3 times it's 100, it comes up to 99 or something.
So some people say that Ashrei can count towards the brachas. Right. There's someone wrote a whole book, I don't know if it was a book or a big pamphlet, like Mea Brachot Kehilchata. How do you say 100 brachas the exact right way? So you can see. So that's one possibility. Another possibility here, which is cited by the Mishnah Berurah, is that in general, there are different categories of blessings. One category is whenever I'm going to enjoy something, I have to first say a blessing. And the reason for that is because it's inappropriate to use God's world to gain benefit out of it without first acknowledging that God created this. This is part of, I'm using it because of my relationship with God. So that idea is sort of part of all of these brachas, right? We're enjoying the world. I'm enjoying the fact that I have my soul again, that I can see, that I have clothes on, that I'm walking not on the ocean but on dry land, that I have shoes and so on. So all of these things are related in that way. And the Mishnah Berurah says, Keshir v'chul, it's the last source before part two, Kol ha-bracho te'elu, hu mishum de'asur lo la'adam lihanot min ha'olam azah bli bracha, v'chol hanen min ha'olam azah bli bracha ke'ilu ma'al. So all of these things are because your person is not allowed to get benefit out of the world without a bracha. If he did, it's like he took something that was kodesh, set aside for holy purposes, and profaned it. So that's a second possibility. The last possibility we already saw before, which was discussed by the Rashba, which we saw a little bit earlier, which is that I'm in a world which is sort of like a new world. There's an idea that every day I'm encountering a new world that's created fresh, and so I'm reacting to sort of like a kind of amazement that I'm reacting to this new world. Wow, there's ground, and I can see, and I have clothes on, and I'm walking, and I'm straight. I was bent over, now I can straighten out. And it's sort of like a reaction of amazement to the world, which I thought was very interesting. It's very informative that's an idea for an ideal for us. They were supposed to try and sort of look at the world fresh every day with the kind of like amazement of like a child or whatever, somebody that has never seen this before. This is unbelievable. I can't, and I'm alive, and I have a chance to do all kinds of amazing things in terms of my service of God, whatever else I'm doing in the day. That's maybe an interesting lesson, that if you look at the world from that perspective every day, then maybe you'll have a better chance to achieve things, and you'll have a better outlook on stuff. So those are three possibilities for this main chunk of brachas, which is either that it's simply to fill out your 100 brachas for the day, or it's this notion that I don't want to misuse the world. I don't want to use the world without acknowledging God's presence, without acknowledging the fact that God made it and is giving it to me, and possibly also because the world is created anew and I'm supposed to approach the world in that way. Okay, there's still time. Everyone okay still? Keep going. Mm-hmm. Now we get to a little bit of the controversial part here. There's three more brachas of Birkut HaShachar, which are not part of this set of sources, which take source somewhere else. And those are the three. I was not made as a non-Jew, I was not made a woman, a slave, and I was not made a woman. That's the way we say, Shelo Asani Goy, Shelo Asani Eved, Shelo Asani Isha. So let's look a little bit at the background here, and then we'll discuss it afterwards.
It says Bordeaux.
Yeah, so okay. There's a few different sources for these brachas, and most of them have slightly different language. Also, as you'll see here, it says Asani Yisrael, not Shelo Asani Goy, which is not the same. Tanya, this one is from the Gemara. There's ones from slightly earlier sources as well. I didn't include them all. Some of them have different variations. So we see Tanya Haya Rabbi Meir Omer Chayav Adam Levarech Shalosh Brachot B'chol Yom. A person has to make three blessings every day. Eluhan, these are them. Sha'asani Yisrael, that God made me a Jew, as opposed to non-Jew. Shelo Asani Isha, who has not made me a woman. And Shelo Asani Bur, who has not made me a translated as a boorish person, a person that's not intelligent or capable, or a person that's empty, either spiritually empty. Bor is a pit, yeah.
Oh, it's bor?
I think it's pronounced, they're both pronounced bor, but you're right. It could be
vavresh?
Yeah, and there could be parallel there. It's just like a pit is empty, so this person is also empty. Hasn't made me an empty person. My life is filled with knowledge and meaning, mm-hmm. and so on. When it comes down to the, without going through all the different sources, when it comes down to the actual halacha, I just brought the Shulchan Aruch here, we obviously don't say it this way. We say it in a different sequence and with different words. The brachas that we make are Tzarech Levarech B'chol Yom Shelo Asani Oved Kochavim, Shelo Asani Eved, and Shelo Asani Isha. Those are the three things that you say every day. So, why are we doing this? What exactly is going on here? So obviously the most controversial part of this, it stands to be debated, but is Shelo Asani Isha. A man says every day, I thank God that I was not created as a woman. In general, one wonders what exactly are we affirming here. I wasn't made as a non-Jew, maybe I can sort of understand. I wasn't made a slave, so maybe the idea is that I'm free as opposed to being a slave. So let's have a look here at the last source, and then we can talk about this a little bit. Yesh od gimel brachot, chitzarech levarech, There are three more brachas a person has to say. One is Shelo Asani Oved Galilim or Oved Kochavim, has not made me a non-Jew. Shetzarech Litein Shevach Vehoda Lamakom. Shebachar Banu Mikol HaOvdei Galilim V'Kervanu LaAvodato. So a person has to give thanks to God that he chose us from amongst all the other idol worshippers and brought us close to his service. That's the explanation for Shelo Asani Akum. As opposed to being people who don't serve God, who are serving idols and things which are useless and things which don't do anything and things which are meaningless, God has brought us close to him. So that's sort of a divide that you can
use the word Avachochavim, right?
Yeah, it's Ovid. So sometimes
so
it's spelled
star worshippers.
Yeah, sometimes it's spelled it's spelled Akum, Ayin Kuf Vav Mem, which literally stands for Oved Kochavim Umazalot, someone who serves stars and
Zodiac,
constellations.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's spelled
constellations, sorry. Yeah.
Right, Mazalot, whatever. Zodiac.
Mazalinus Zodiac. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it come in, means roughly the same thing. Yeah. Sometimes it's spelled Ayin Vav Gimel, which is Oved Galilim, which is just the term for pagan worship, and sometimes it's Avodah Zarah, which literally means foreign worship, but we're talking about idol worship. So we understand that we're drawing a distinction. We thank God that we're in a place where we have a relationship with God and we're serving God, as opposed to not. Okay, v'kervanu l'avodato, fine. And then you say, Shelo Asani Eved. You make a bracha, Shelo Asani Eved, af al pi shemevarech Shelo Asani Isha, So what's going on here? We're differentiating between different levels of, I think, along two parameters, what we might call Kedushat Yisrael, holiness, intrinsic holiness of the Jewish people, and obligations to do mitzvot. So an Eved, if we're referring to an Eved Knani, a non-Jewish slave, the way that this system works is when you take on a non-Jewish slave, an Eved Knani, you give him if he's a man, then he has a milah, because every member of your household has to have a brit milah, and you take him, it's not clear if you take him to the mikveh now or not, but basically he commits to be on a track towards becoming fully Jewish. So while he serves you, he has responsibilities where he has a chiyuv to do, a responsibility to do certain mitzvot, but he does not do mitzvot asei shazman gerama, which are time-caused mitzvot, yeah.
Why did you go to the non-Jew becoming a Jew? I mean, Jews were slaves too. I mean,
you're right. So the term Shelo Asani Eved, most straightforwardly, if you would have asked me without seeing the Torah, I would have said, a person that's a slave is not free. They don't have the ability to do... They don't have liberty.
They don't control their time.
They don't control themselves.
Yeah.
But he is looking at this from a perspective of chiyuvim in terms of mitzvot and of kedusha. He's not looking at it from that perspective. We'll talk about that again in a second. So that's what he says. That even though the slave has to do mitzvot, does not have to do time-caused mitzvah. Mitzvot asei shazman gerama. The same way that a woman also is not obligated in those. But the slave, he says, is worse. Why is the slave worse? Because the assumption is, women don't have to do time-caused mitzvot, and slaves also don't, but it's for different reasons. The slave doesn't have to do these mitzvot because he has not yet attained the full status of a Jewish person. It's sort of like, it's like a halfway point. So he doesn't have full kedusha.
Rabbi, I don't know where you get that, because I don't know why you've gone to the point where you're talking about a non-Jew as opposed to a Jewish slave. I know the idolater.
Yes.
But the slave, I don't know why you're referring to...
Because he's talking about Shelo Asani Isha.
Right.
Shegam hi eina chayevet b'mitzvot asei shezman gerama. She too, just like the slave, is not obligated in mitzvot asei shezman gerama.
But that could be a Jewish
slave.
No, a
Jewish slave is fully obligated in all mitzvot.
He's Jewish.
He's Jewish. He's just indentured servant. But he's fully obligated.
Okay.
So if we're mentioning, I agree with you. If I was reading this, that's what I would have said. But he jumped to this conclusion. Yeah.
Okay.
You stated that a Jew has to be circumcised. I was in this very room about 20 years ago. A man in his 70s approached me and he said, you know, I never had a bris.
Mm-hmm.
I said, go on. He said, no, truly, I've never had a bris. I said, how come? He said, I was born in Russia. My father was a fabricator communist. My brother and I did not have a bris. I mentioned the Gabuim, and they, oy vey, we gave Elias and it's
so Jewish.
Well, what have we done? I mentioned the rabbi. He said, It's perfectly in order. It's perfectly proper. Mm-hmm. He can have aliyahs. He can dump them for. He can bowl shofar. The only thing he can't do is Pesach.
Right.
The kabbonis. That's the only thing. Otherwise, so he didn't have a bris. So he didn't have a bris.
True. Okay. I didn't mean to imply that. I didn't mean to imply that you have to have a. But I was just describing the process that normally happens when you have a non-Jewish slave who sort of you take on. That's normally what you do.
But he was somebody who did not have a bris and enjoyed all the benefits.
Of course, yeah. So there's two different cases. There's a person who was born to Jewish parents and he is completely Jewish halakhically, and then there's this the Eved Knani, the non-Jewish slave who is fully not Jewish, and now he's taking on a status which is not quite conversion. It's called becoming a slave. In other words, to be taken on as a servant, as an Eved Knani, what's called an Eved Knani. So this is the process. The process is that you move through levels of attaining higher levels of Kedusha and sanctity until you, when he's freed from his servitude, he becomes fully Jewish, and then he's a fully Jewish person. So that's does that make sense?
So did it use Eved Knani in here? He
doesn't use the term Eved Knani, but I'm just I don't understand any other way to read it, because he's referring to an Eved who is not chayv in mitzvah aseh man grama, as opposed to a woman who also is not obligated. But that's not because of any lack of status. That's just because of other concerns. Whatever, however you want to explain, the Torah exempted women from time caused mitzvah.
So you know why I have a conflict with this?
Yeah.
Because you started off by talking shalosh ani goy,
yes,
and that is the idea of a non-Jew. But you've brought into the idea of a non-Jew when you talk about an Eved, and
yes.
I just don't see. We've already talked about
the idea of a
non-Jew, but why do you throw that on to the slave?
So the idea that the Torah seems to be describing here is that there are three different levels. There's a level of a person that's totally not Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
There's the level of a person who's halfway. You have a slave who has a certain obligation to the mitzvah and who has a certain level of sanctity and status as a Jew, like a halfway status. And then there's a woman who is totally, has kedusha, sanctity, holiness as a Jew, 100%, but there are certain mitzvot that she's not obligated to do.
So I look at it, and I hear that. I hear your point. I look at it as in terms of ability to reach your full potential. So a non-Jew is limited because they all have the Shevach, the laws of Noach. That's all they have. The slave is limited because he cannot exercise his free will. He is, so in other words, while he may have some obligations, and I'm looking at a Jewish slave, by the way, a Jewish slave will have ability to do some obligations. Truthfully, he doesn't have the freedom that a non-Jewish slave does. And a woman who, you know, for whatever is limited from her potential spiritually because she has to confine herself to those time controlled mitzvot, the obligations that prevent her. So it's, I look at it as basically a progression as opposed to in terms of reaching the potential from spirituality as opposed to, because I think I look at the idolater and the slave in your view, I they're one and the same. So it doesn't address necessarily the slave who's a Jew.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. This series of brachot,
right.
I mean, just, you know, I really had hoped there would be more time to discuss.
No,
it's not because of you. But this series of brachot, obviously, from someone from a modern kind of perspective, can leave you with all kinds of problems. Just like in terms of sensibilities. And I'm not saying that I don't have these problems.
I have.
Right? So this is sort of something that you have to think about and struggle with. What I thought, just in terms of approaching this kind of issue, is to try and look at the sources head on and see what they say and try and figure out what exactly is being communicated here and then see how that fits in terms of your feelings about it. Because part of the idea of learning Torah in general is that the values that are in the Torah may not be the same values that we have. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to try and seek instruction here and see how, and it might create a struggle. And I'm not saying that I am totally at peace with these brachot. So this was one, but this is one explanation, and somebody might say, well, that sounds very like elitist, and it sounds sort of exclusionary. You're saying, wow, we're better than the non-Jews, and we're better than the slaves, however you want to take slaves, and we're better than, and the man has to say that he's better than women, and so that can
be... It doesn't
be,
say he's better than a woman, though. It says right. that they, just because you have not made, you say that, it doesn't mean you're saying you're better than a woman.
Right, so you have to say something, I mean, you have to say something. It's very hard for me to sort of understand it that way. And let me just say there's two pathways here. One of them is that there's very strange cultural parallels. You find parallel statements of these three groupings in a bunch of other places. There's a book, if I can hopefully pronounce the name properly, Diogenes Laertius. I studied it when I was in university and philosophy, where this person collected, it was like a Greek writer, a Roman writer, that collected a bunch of statements of Greek philosophers. And one of the statements that he had, which either was attributed to Plato or to Thales or whatever, is, I thank the gods every day, or I thank God, whatever he thanked every day, that he has created me as a Greek and not a barbarian, as a free man and not as a slave, and as a man and not as a woman. Which is exactly the same three-part mm-hmm. description that we have right. here. There's also a verse, which I saw only because I Googled just these three things today, in part of the New Testament, in Galatians, which I don't know, I'm not familiar. But also, I mean, this is already could be reacting to Jewish sources, but there it also says there are no Jews and non-Jews, or Jews and Christians. There are no... there are no slaves and free men, there are no men and women, everyone is one, because now, whatever. Like, but you see the same three-way, and it pops up in other places also, which could lead one to conclude that this was a cultural reality, that some people say this. I don't know if this is apologetic or not. Mm-hmm. Some people say this was the culture in the time of Chazal, this is how they viewed the world, and it could have been that sociologically, you know, men relative to women, free men relative to slaves, and of course each person in their own religious views was better than everybody else, and they're thankful for that. That leaves me with problems today, because I don't know exactly how to compute that in terms of today's standards and today's culture and today's social reality.
But yeah. From what you just said, it makes more sense now, because it's more like none of these three have exercised free will.
Okay.
They're all confined by something. So the idolater is confined by, you know, he's stuck by idolatry, which is really, and could be, you know, it's an addiction almost. The slave has no free will because he's his master, and the woman doesn't have complete free will because she has to abide by time, you know, those
well,
things.
Well, the social idea would be the woman doesn't have complete autonomy because just socially,
right.
They did not have women did not have complete autonomy. That's one track. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to feel about that. If I was like real academic, maybe I'd feel better. Just briefly, the other track is to ground this in terms of the halacha, which is what we've seen, that there are halachic distinctions or realistic distinctions between these three categories, in which case a person is thanking God for the opportunity to be involved in more and more levels of service of God. I'm a Jew and not a non-Jew. I have the opportunity to be part of the Jewish people and serve God. I am a free person, not a slave, depending on how you want to slice that. Say, if you want to talk about Jewish slaves, it could be talking about autonomy. If you want to talk about this technical middle ground of the non-Jewish slave, then it's about the fact that I have more obligations in mitzvot. And a man and not a woman, so I have this source here from Rabbi Reuven Margoliot, which I saw somewhere, which is nice. Which is that he points out, I'll just read in English, a woman is not punished if she does not fulfill time-determined positive commandments. And her share in the world to come is like that of a man. In other words, there's full, absolute Jewishness on both sides, and the fact is the Torah just exempted women from certain mitzvot. So maybe I would have said, I wish I was in that position, right? A man wakes up in the morning, doesn't put on tefillin, he did something wrong. He didn't go to shul, he did something wrong. He doesn't say Shema, he did something wrong. Etc., 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 etc. A woman is not bound, obligated in these mitzvot, so there's nothing bad that happened. A woman doesn't put on tefillin, nothing bad happens. Doesn't say Kriyat Shema, nothing bad happens. She can say Kriyat Shema, no, I don't want to talk about tefillin. So.
Yeah, but to start, if I can be frank here,
yeah.
I would have been very careful not to put this in the thing in the future, because if you have women here, I just think that it's, and of course, maybe religious women would think differently, although I don't think so, but it would be a way to say this religion is out of touch.
Well, I was hoping that we would be able to have a kind of dialogue about it and to be able to talk about, you know.
Well, Robertson Stern always said, I don't have to be reminded that I'm Jewish.
So this is a sort of thing. So he says here, this is the idea, women will not be punished for these things and men will. So maybe a man would have taken the perspective, you know, it would be much better for me not to be obligated in all of these things. And he has to make a bracha in the morning to say, no, I'm thankful that even though it comes with a tremendous amount of risk, that I have the opportunities to be obligated in these things. I don't know if this is a fulfilling bottom of the line answer. I'm not certain that I have found a fulfilling bottom of the line.
See, a woman can turn around, and I hear you. A woman can turn around and say, you know what? Who gets glory in the synagogue, in the sanctuary? It's men. So this is almost like feeding into the fact that it's another hit, you know, for a woman that. You know, it's almost acknowledging that role is not as glorious as that of a man. Like right. A man, you know, getting aliyah for the Torah, hagba, whatever it is, it's something that a man does. And a woman just, like, has to sit back and, I don't know, it's just...
Right. These remarks could be prefaced, maybe should have been prefaced, with the statement that what is clear, one way or another, is that Judaism is not egalitarian. Mm-hmm. If egalitarian means that men and women have the exact same roles.
Right. Yep.
But beyond that point, in terms of, you know, inherent value, inherent spiritual capacity, and so on, we don't necessarily make claims like that. And I think at least what's important, even if these answers are not satisfying, is what I said before, which I think is important, is that when we come up with these kind of issues, there are things that you will learn. There are parts of our religion. We're trying to figure out why we do things. So sometimes why we do things may make us feel unsettled. Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad thing. Part of religious growth is that you engage with issues, things that make you feel uncomfortable, and try and struggle with it. What I think is important, though, is just to try and mute your own values and your own preconceived approach to the topic as much as you can until you at least discover what are the sources saying, and then try and engage with them. So that's probably, I mean, I definitely hear that, I accept the criticism, and I wasn't sure to do it or not. But I didn't.
So,
I think the women aren't here.
No, but it's an interesting point. But going forward, maybe one of the whys can be really more of a why is woman's role in prayer, in Jewish prayer, structured as it is? If you look at a Shir Chadash or a partnership minyan or whatever, they say based on halakha, women can do this, this, and this.
Of the brachas without a minyan. Some people do, yeah.
But
200 women can make a minyan.
But that would be an interesting topic in and of itself as to halakhically what can they do or what can't they do and what are the sources for those.
Right, I hear. Potential. Okay.
Square.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Steve.